So tonight we're here with Eric, and he's going to be with us for 4 weeks. And I'd like to introduce him.
Good evening. My name is Eric. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Eric.
Grateful to be here tonight. Grateful that the group asked me to come out and share my experience, strength, and hope. And the first page I was ever pointed out to in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous as a newcomer was this one.
Right.
My sponsor said, "This is exactly what you know about recovery." Nothing. Right? And kind of took offense to that because I'm a sensitive alcoholic. He would say, "You're thick-headed and thin-skinned," right? So I'm gonna jump around a little bit, but I actually want to start with the forward to the first edition on page XIII. It says, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body." They use the word recovered. There's this big debate in AA about recovering and recovered, right? I like to go with what the literature tells me and not so much what the fellowship tells me. So I can recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book, which means this is a textbook, right? This is going to tell me how I can recover from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experience will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend the alcoholic is a very sick person. And besides, we are sure that our way of living has advantages for all. It is important that we remain anonymous because we are too few at present to handle the overwhelming number of personal appeals which may result from the publication. Being mostly business and professional folk, we could not well carry on our occupations in such an event. We would like it understood that our alcoholic work is an advocation. When writing or speaking publicly about alcoholism, we urge each of our fellowship to omit his personal name, designating himself instead as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Very earnestly, we ask the press to do also to observe this request, for otherwise we shall be gravely handicapped." And, this is starting to lay out some of our traditions already. Without them even knowing it, before the traditions were even formed, there was definitely some wisdom and some divine intervention when Bob and Bill got together. It says, "We are not an organization in the conventional sense of the word. There are no fees or dues whatsoever. The only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. We are not allied with any particular faith, sect, denomination, nor do we oppose anyone. We simply wish to be helpful to those who are afflicted. We shall be interested to hear from those who are getting results from this book, particularly from those who have commenced work with other alcoholics. We should like to be helpful to such cases. Inquiries by scientific, medical, and religious societies will be welcomed." And again, it's starting to lay out the groundwork for some of the traditions, outside issues, and things of that nature. And whenever I read this book, the more I'm amazed how our founders were with regards to their thinking, and how they were in the thinking in the future without even knowing it. I could read this book a billion times and get something different out of it every time I read it. So it talks about the medical view, right? It talks about religious view. So these societies have been great benefactors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And actually, there's a couple of things before we get to the doctor's opinion. Something that was pointed out to me. And the observations in the back of the book from the medical view on page 570. And I found this to be an interesting observation from another doctor, from another outside opinion. It says, "Dr. W.W. Bauer, broadcasting under the auspices of the American Medical Association in 1946 over the NBC network, said in part, 'Alcoholics Anonymous are no crusaders, not a temperance society. They know that they must never drink. They help others with similar problems.'" And this is an important sentence here. "In this atmosphere, the alcoholic often overcomes his excessive concentration upon himself, learning to depend upon a higher power and absorb himself in his work with other alcoholics. He remains sober day by day. The days add up into weeks, the weeks into months, and into years. Selfishness and self-centered is my problem, right? And it tells me how I get out of that by helping others. And this is somebody who wasn't an alcoholic, who had a view of our fellowship, and was willing to write some things in the back of our book as far as their observations are concerned. And then there's the religious view of Father Ed Dowling talking about Catholics becoming better Catholics as a result of practicing the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's amazing how all this came together. You know, and what I want to do is I want to skip over to the doctor's opinion. And being only 4 weeks and being short on some time, I'm going to go to actually to his, I'm going to start with his second letter to Alcoholics Anonymous. Says the subject presented, and it's on XXVII. Said the subject presented in this book seems to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as a medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was therefore a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What, with all our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. And that's a humbling statement for a doctor at a well-known hospital for alcoholic and drug addiction, right? What he's basically telling me there is that he can't help me. I'm beyond human aid. And back then, their ultra-modern technology was like shock treatment and belladonna treatment and some really serious stuff. If you were an alcoholic back then, before Alcoholics Anonymous, normally you were thrown away. You were locked away from society. Because as this doctor says, this good doctor says, he, with all his synthetic knowledge, he can't help me, right? Many years ago, one of the leading contributors of this book came under our care in this hospital. And while here, he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. This is a time frame. I go to a lot of meetings. Don't drink, go to meetings. You know, keep coming, right? They talk about that later on in this letter. I think it's called Frothy Emotional Appeal, right? Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving, we consented. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men, as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in the alcoholic field. They believe in themselves, and still more, in a power which pulls chronic alcoholics from the gates of death. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before physical psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. So as far as the phenomenon of craving, which is going to talk about here, for me, I had to be dry. I had to be locked away in rehab. That's how it worked for me, to be away from society and to be separated from alcohol. I need to be physically separated from alcohol. Otherwise, on my own accord, I wasn't going to be able to do it. So rehab came in handy for me with that case, right? It says, we believe, and so suggests a few years ago, that the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this case class, and never occurs in the average tempered drinker. The allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. And so I have an allergy. And so what happens for me is I recover from the mental obsession as a result of the steps and helping other alcoholics. What I don't recover from is the physical allergy. Right? The truth is, by God's grace and mercy, I was able to celebrate 9 years on the 2nd of October. And if I were to pick up a drink today, the phenomenon of craving would kick in and I would be off to the races again. Right? Because I have a physical allergy to alcohol. It's an abnormal reaction. The average tempered drinker, really, when they could take it or leave it, because they have a different reaction to alcohol than I do, right? Somebody who doesn't have the allergy, when they drink, they feel like they're losing control, right? They're a little dizzy. Oh, I don't feel good. I think I'm going to put it down. I have the opposite effect, right? For me, it feels like that I'm gaining control the more I drink, right? It's a delusion. And so I'm not an average tempered drinker. I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, right? And it says, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices, right? Talked about that just earlier. Don't drink and go to meetings. To me, that's frothy emotional appeal, right? The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideas must, it's a must, doesn't say suggest, must be grounded in the power greater themselves if they are to recreate their lives. If any feel that as a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us a while on the firing line. See the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. The solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments. And the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel, after many years of experience, that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. That's a profound statement from a doctor. Right? That is a profound statement for a doctor. Once again, he's telling me that he can't help me. But the movement, which is going to be developed in AA between Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson, the altruistic movement, those who are looking to help others, that will help me. And, you know, so when another alcoholic sits down with me, or when I sit down with another alcoholic, my past, my alcoholic past, which I thought was horrendous, which I thought I would never share with anybody, actually becomes the greatest asset and weapon in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I sit down with another alcoholic, I have some real experience of what it's like to be of the hopeless variety, right? Because I've been there and I've done that, you know? So I can bring my past and use it as a weapon against alcoholism, right? Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because what I didn't realize is that alcoholism doesn't come in bottles and cans. Alcoholism comes in people. And what I suffer from is a spiritual malady. And when I launched into a course of vigorous action and I got to take inventory, I began to realize that my alcoholism has always been there. And it talks about that more on, and we'll cover that later on. But I drink for the effect produced by alcohol. I heard somebody say at a meeting once that alcohol gave me wings, taught me how to fly, and took away the sky. Right? Because of my abnormal reaction to alcohol, it gives me everything. Right? That ease and comfort. So it says, the sensation is so elusive that they admit it is injurious. Right? I admit maybe when I drink there's some consequences, right? And what I like to say is that when I first picked up the drink, the unacceptable over a period of time became acceptable, because what I do in my alcoholism is that I rationalize and justify my right to drink because of the feeling it gives me. Right? And I had a long list of nevers before I picked up my first drink at the age of 18. And that list got shorter and shorter and shorter the longer I stayed out there abusing alcohol and other things, right? And I would draw a line in the sand, tell myself I'm never going to cross that line. I'd come to from a blackout, realize I just crossed that line, I'd draw another line in the sand a little bit lower, right? And, you know, so this is the setup for Alkalogic, I like to call it, right? The Alkalogic. The fact that I am protecting, I'm guarding my solution. Because without alcohol, I don't have another solution. Prior to picking up a drink, the effect that I was looking for was the ease and comfort. But prior to picking up the drink, I didn't have ease and comfort. Part of my dis-ease is comparison. I compare your outsides to my insides. I had a syndrome in high school called friends with everyone and close to no one, arm's length, right? I'm deeply insecure and I'm full of fear. Although I don't know this, my behavior would tell me otherwise if I were awake to it. You know, step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, which to me means I had been spiritually asleep for 29 years of my life prior to coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and actually taking an honest appraisal of my life, right? So it goes on to say that I can't differentiate the true from the false, right? That alcohol life is the only normal one I know. And, you know, I remember, you know, getting my my second DUI. I was involved in a very very odd relationship. And what I didn't realize is the man that I met, who was my upper 30s when I met him, I was 17, had his own problems and his own sickness. And I remember we sold my grandmother on his grandiose ideas of buying and flipping real estate, right? So she wrote me a check for $10,000 because we were going to do this thing. We're going to, right? And I was 24 years old. I had bought the house. I was one-third owner of the house. I didn't realize the money I was giving this guy was going to the drug dealer and the liquor store, right? So the mortgage wasn't being paid. And it's funny because, like Bill says in his story, I had arrived, right? I escaped Mayville, New Jersey. I had a $300,000 townhouse that I was one-third owner of. And I'd call my friends from Mayville to come up and see how I made it out of Mayville, New Jersey, because nobody escapes Mayville, New Jersey. Nobody. And, you know, the parties were big in the beginning, and then over a period of time, they got smaller and smaller and smaller. And he would lock himself up in his room with his stash. I'd lock myself down in my room with my stash. The only time we'd communicate is when somebody ran out of something, and you get the little knock on the door. And I also began to realize the unhealthiness of this relationship, and there was a reason why he asked me to move in with him from the beginning. I was 17 when I met the guy, and I looked like I was 9. Literally, I looked like a little kid. In fact, he worked at VIP Honda at the time as a service writer, and I went to go get my car serviced, and he was looking around the corner for my parents. I was like, no, it's my car. I need service. And that was a setup for a very odd relationship in which I would be a victim of, not always a victim, but for the most part, a victim of sexual abuse. Because of my baby face and what he was looking for, there was a reason why he always invited me into his life and had me, you know, got me jobs to make money and kind of took care of me. I'd come to from blackouts feeling very violated. You know, here's a never list, right? And I would keep going back. That was my mistake. The unacceptable becomes acceptable. And that ease and comfort I get at once by taking a few drinks, I chase that and I rationalize and justify my behavior. And I put my behavior and circumstance aside only to get the next one. Because, see, for me, without alcohol and drugs in my system, I have a problem. It's a sobriety problem. I'm irritable, restless, and discontent. It talks about that right here. You know, I'm irritable, restless, and discontent unless I can again experience the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks I see others take with impunity, which means other people seem to drink without consequence, right? After I have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops, and I pass through a well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless I can have experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope for my recovery. And it goes on to give me a promise here, actually, which is a great promise. It says, on the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol. The only effort necessary, right, being that required, not a suggestion, to follow a few simple rules. And that's what I had to do. I'm not really big into rules. I'm a rebellious alcoholic, right? So I had to be pretty badly mangled, as it says in our reading further on. It says, men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal. Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me. Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it is often not enough. One feels that something more, again, more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to ordinary psychological approach. And again, this is the doctor admitting he can't help me, right? This is like the third time already he's telling me he can't help me, right? So I seem to be doomed, right? I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I've had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date, favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to that date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape, they were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. And so I am not recovered from the physical allergy. And I was also thinking about, too, as far as the mental piece of this dis-ease, is that I began to realize that I didn't really need to actually have the alcohol in my system before I got that ease and comfort. There became a point in time where just holding the bottle, knowing that I was going to take that drink in just a moment, I got the ease and comfort before the alcohol even entered my system. Right? Just holding the bottle, I felt, because I knew oblivion was next. I wouldn't have to deal with the guilt, shame, and remorse of the night before, or how I woke up not knowing what happened the night before, but waking up feeling very violated. You know, it's funny because people would often come to me and talk to me about why they, you know, see people catch him when I was blacked out in my room, sneaking into my room at night. And he would take advantage of me when I was in a blackout, right? And it's funny because when I go on further for the fourth and fifth step, when I sat down with my sponsor, he told me I was going to put down on paper exactly who I'm not so I could be what God intended me to be. And so I'm not that person. But the unacceptable becomes acceptable. And I rationalize and justify my right to drink. And I just kind of brush off that behavior as maybe it won't happen next time. You know, maybe next time I'll be able to handle my liquor like a gentleman. And the truth is, there was brief periods and moments in time when I did. Oh, did that fuel my alcoholic ego. Right? I had a job in Manhattan. I'd hop on the train. I was in outside sales, so I can identify with this, right? I would have appointments where I was going to close a big deal that afternoon. And I'd go to the bar. And I tell myself, I'm just going to have one. That appointment was never kept. You know? And I would have to scramble the next day to try to make up some excuse of why I missed the appointment. Boy, was that a job, huh? Being in active alcoholism wasn't easy. But I had no other solution. You know, I lost a lot of business that way from the liquid lunch. So I tried to schedule my appointments in the morning. Sometimes that didn't even work. Because when I made it back to New Jersey, there was often times where I wouldn't make it back to New York. And I played this game. And I have suits in the closet in work because I knew there was a good chance I wasn't going to end up looking very, very well. And I'd come to in random places in the Bronx. And sometimes I'd get as far as to Penn Station and somehow, some way pass out. I'd get the nightstick. I come to, I'm all bloody and disheveled. I have no idea what happened the night before. And, you know, a white boy in a suit in some of the places I probably ended up in probably has no business being there. And, and I'd stumble back to the office. I'd see all the people coming in from New Jersey in the morning, and I'd be like, damn, I probably should have been part of that crowd. But I'd stumble back to the office. It'd be like 6 a.m., and I'd go in, and I'd put on a fresh suit. Sometimes I'd keep the same tie on, or you know, I'd try to wash up the best I could. And at this point, I would look in the mirror, and I would promise to myself that I wasn't going to do it again. And if you hooked me up to a lie detector test, I meant it. I was sincere. And, you know, by noon, I'd be doing it all over again. You know? And so it's irritable, restless, and discontent. You know? And then, and so I don't understand that I have a problem, because I can't differentiate the true from the false. And the alcoholic life is the only one that I know until I have another solution, right? Until I have another solution besides alcohol. And so I'm going to go on to the rest of this reading. So this classification of alcoholics seems most difficult, and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We are all familiar with this one, this type. They're always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. I can identify with that. There is a type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is a type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is a manic depressive type who is, perhaps, the least understood and by his friends, and about whom a whole chapter can be written. There are types entirely normal in every respect except for the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. And I've tried many different ways to monitor my drinking in the beginning. And, you know, at the point when I was 24 years old, we were losing the house. The bank was about to take it. But we sold it right before the bank took it, and we made some money. And I was working at a place called Suburban Furniture. The house was in Ledgewood. Suburban Furniture was down Route 10, and I didn't have a license after my second DUI, which I was mandated to do a 16-week IDRC program, which probably took me 8.5 years to finish. You know, but I didn't have a problem. No issues here, right? So I'd walk to Suburban Furniture. I also worked at Chi Chi's restaurant as a waiter. Like, so I was working and doing my thing and drinking. And I remember I was in the parking lot of Suburban Furniture one day, and he came and met me at my job and handed me my 1/3 profit of the house. And I went from a $300,000 townhouse to a 4x6 room on Mechanic Street in Sukasana, again, close to where I could walk to work. And he handed me an envelope with $20,000+ cash. That money was gone in 4 months. I just got a young lady pregnant who was married. I was a father. Something I said I was never going to be, because I never had one. And I got to tell you, in the midst of my alcoholism and my addiction, she was not a blessing at that time. Here I am living in a 4x6 room. I had a microwave. That was my kitchen. I lived with another guy who was my roommate, who had his own room. Another guy, and we shared this dingy bathroom. It was totally illegal setup. It was $400 a month. And here I am. I'm going from a townhouse, a beautiful townhouse. We never got to the flipping and buying real estate. That never happened, right? That we sold my grandmother that idea. And grandma never got her $10,000 back, right? Because I spent it on drugs and alcohol. And that's how I was living my life. But I couldn't differentiate the true from the false. To me, that was a normal life, you know? And I figured, you know what? I'm going to live with my daughter and the ex. And maybe if I had some family structure, that would slow down my drinking. And it was only a matter of a year where I was coming home in blackouts, escorted home by the Roxbury police, only to be told to have my 2-year-old daughter being woken up by the police and my antics to wonder why daddy's coming home with the police. And I ran. That's what I do, I run. So I moved back into Chatham, New Jersey, in an apartment with the guy who was sexually abusing me. Because that was the right thing to do. You know? And why was that? Well, because he had the stuff that I wanted. Alcohol and drugs. Never growing up as a young man did I ever think I would subject myself to such misery. You know, and pain. And never did I want to hurt anybody, but I did. I never meant to end up in jail. Many times I did. I never meant to be in detoxes. Many times I've been there. But I still couldn't see. I was still holding on, you know, because there was short periods, brief periods where I didn't drink. But I forget about the other things I did in substitution to the drink, right? So I always had to be medicated somehow, some way, because I couldn't handle life on life's terms. And October 1st, 2009, I was a stumbling, bumbling, hopeless, hope to die drunk. And on October 2nd, on my way to rehab, I lost the obsession to drink or take drugs. And I'm going to go over to more about alcoholism, chapter 3, page 30. And this is really talks about some of step 1. Says more about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think that he is bodily or mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is a great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. And as I described, that was my life. I pursued it to the gates of insanity or near death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step of recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or Presley maybe, has to be smashed. It's a tough thing when I don't have a solution to smash that old idea, right? It talks about how it works. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. And one of my old ideas was I thought I need to feel good all the time. I didn't realize how that was fueling my alcoholism and my drug addiction. The truth is, it's unattainable to feel good all the time. It's just not possible. Because when I went into a rough patch of my life, which was really a full decade once I picked up my first drink at the age of 18, when I had those feelings of terror, bewilderment, frustration, and desperation, when I had these uneasy feelings, and when I wasn't feeling good, I thought that if I didn't take something, I was going to feel that way for the rest of my life. Not knowing that feelings pass. Not knowing that everything is temporary. Right, so this illusion that I can feel good all the time, that also had to be smashed. Sometimes simply okay not to be okay. And I can tell you in my 9-year journey in recovery, there's been times where I haven't been okay. And that's been okay. Because it's past. Right? And it says, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us have felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to a pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. And that's my setup. Right? And I've explained that, you know, the setup to, to try to protect my right to drink because I don't have another solution. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there has been brief recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree that there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but hasn't done so yet. Despite all we say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they are in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing an inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. And the controlled portion of my drinking, or the trying to control my drinking, didn't really come until the end. I'd say maybe the last 3 years of my drinking is when I was starting to recognize that this isn't normal. That there's something wrong with my life here. And the vain attempts. And, you know, I wouldn't say brief period of recovery. It was a brief period of abstinence, you know. Or the time that I walked away from the bar after having one drink. Right? And I pat myself on the back. See, Eric, you're not an alcoholic. It always got worse. And, this book describes me and my progression to a T. I almost thought that they wrote this book about me at some point, you know. And that's really the common bond that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, is not so much the circumstances of our lives, but really the feelings, the emotions, and why we feel a need to put poison in our bodies to begin with. Irritable, restless, and discontent. You know, that low-lying level of the inability to form true relationships with other people. You know, the lack of trust. You know, all these things that I had been bedeviled by for my whole life, but didn't really realize it, right? So really, I had to concede to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. And on that day, on October 2nd, 2009, I can't say I had anything to do with that. You know, there's a debate in AA about the educational variety and the white light experience, right? The burning bush. And, I always thought I had the educational variety. And the truth is that that day, on October 2nd, 2009, on my way to rehab, I was being transported from Kearney Detox down to Endeavor House in Keyport in the white van. I had lost the obsession for a moment to drink or use drugs. And the further I get away from that moment in time, the more I begin to realize that was sudden, it was profound, and it was clearly something that can only happen by a power greater than myself. Because prior to that date, I had no ability to turn off that switch. If I wasn't thinking about drinking or using, you know, if I wasn't using it, I was thinking about it. I was obsessing over it. God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, even though I had no relationship, so I thought, with God. I claim myself an atheist. You know, I damn people in their Sunday best. I wouldn't step foot in a place like this. You know, this was not my MO. You know, I was the guy who would debate the proof of the existence of God, right? I was that guy. I was that guy that would debate with you. And I had a boss in Manhattan who was my sales manager, who was a Jehovah's Witness. And I remember, you know, after I get done with my my work day, when I made it through the full work day, and I actually made it back to the office at 5 o'clock, we'd sit in his office and I would debate him on the existence of God, you know, in all my angst, right? And he never really tried to force anything on me, right? And he just kind of listened to it. He didn't defend it. And now that I know that, I don't have to defend my faith. You know? I went from an atheist to a born-again Christian, by the way, who goes to church on Sunday. Because I'm an extremist. Right? I'm an all-or-nothing kind of guy. And And when they said that a man who fails to enlarge his spiritual life will drink again, I kind of took that literally, and I started interviewing churches. And it's actually enhanced my recovery for me. It's an addition to. I'm never subtracting AA from the equation, because this is where I found God in AA and through the 12 steps, right? So I think about that moment in time, and you know, I it totally blew over my head. You know, at that moment, I didn't realize what was happening. I didn't recognize that there was clearly something intervening in my life, because I was sitting in rehab in the Kumbaya circles, and we cheer about our feelings. And I would leave out the word God in front of the Serenity Prayer. And I would be like, I need some evidence of this God business. And I had a temporary sponsor who would drive me back and forth to rehab, or from rehab to the meetings out there, so I didn't have to go in what I call the druggy buggy, right, the white van. And we'd have this discussion about God, and I'd tell him my feelings. And I realized he was helping me take a second step. And he said, obviously, Eric, drugs and alcohol is a power greater than yourself, don't you think? He said, you're in an institution, and normal people don't end up in institutions. I said, well, you got a good point there. Yet another moment of clarity that I completely missed, went completely over my head. And he said, look, I want you to do me a suggestion, just a favor. I want you to pick something. And I don't care what you want to believe in, but pick something. I said, okay, I believe in karma. I believe in rupa chaso, what goes around comes around. And that was a good beginning, but looking back on that now, that was probably not a good conception based on the way I used to live, right, to get what I thought was going to bring me happiness. If karma was a real higher power, I probably wouldn't be sitting here today, right? But it was a beginning, and AA gives me that liberty, right? AA gives me the hoop is much bigger, right, that I have to jump through. And he said, I want you to do me a favor, just a suggestion. I want you to drop to your knees in the morning. And I thought this guy was crazy. He said, I want you to ask your karma to redirect your thinking and help guide you through a 24-hour period of sobriety. And with the gift of desperation, because all my scorecards are at zero, I agreed to take that suggestion. He said, when you make it through a day without picking up a drink or drug, I want you to drop to your knees again and thank your karma for another day of sobriety. And that was mid-October of 2009, and I haven't missed a day since. And when I realized that guy actually was helping me take my second step, without knowing it. And so, for me, willingness is about demonstration. I knew at that point I was probably done, because I was willing to do things I didn't believe in. But I did it anyway, because I was pretty badly mangled by my alcoholism, right? It talks about it in here. I'm going to go to We Agnostics. I'm going to read page 53. I'm going to start with the paragraph that says, logic is great stuff. So the logic is great stuff. We liked it. We still like it. It is not by chance we are given the power to reason, to examine the evidence of our senses, and to draw conclusions. This is one of man's magnificent attributes. We agnostically inclined would not feel satisfied with a proposal which does not lend itself to a reasonable approach and interpretation. And that was my argument, right? Hence, we are at pains to tell why we think our present faith is reasonable, why we think it is more sane and logical to believe than not to believe, why we say our former thinking was soft and mushy when we threw up our hands in doubt and said, we don't know. And when we became, this is a great line for me, when we became alcoholics, crushed by self-imposed crises, I can say I was definitely crushed by a self-imposed crisis, right? We could not postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else God is nothing. God either is or He isn't. What is our choice to be? And I guess if this guy would have read this paragraph to me at that point in time, I might have told him to go, you know, go somewhere with that. But what I realized today is that's exactly what I was doing when I was taking that suggestion. You know, when I was taking that suggestion that I didn't believe in. At that point, without even knowing it, I was making God everything. It's impossible for me to be separated from my Creator. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. I never knew that, right? I thought I was apart from God, but it's impossible to be apart from God. You know? It says, when we arrived at this point, we were squarely confronted with the question of faith. We couldn't duck the issue. Some of us had already walked far over the bridge of reason toward the desired shore of faith. The outliners and the promise of a new land brought luster to tired eyes and fresh courage to flanking spirits. Friendly hands had stretched out in welcome. We were grateful that reason had brought us so far, but somehow we couldn't quite step ashore. Perhaps we had been leaning too heavily on reason the last mile, and we did not like to lose our support. This was natural, but let us think a little more closely. Without knowing it, had we not been brought to where we stood by a certain kind of faith? For did we not believe in our own reasoning? Did we not have confidence in our own ability to think? What was that but a sort of faith? Yes, we had been faithful, objectively faithful, to the God of reason. So in one way or another, we discovered that faith had been involved all the time. I always had faith. Always. I had faith that when I took that drink, it was going to do for me what I couldn't do for myself. Right? I had faith when I took that hit or took that pill, it was going to do for me what I couldn't do for myself. I had misguided faith. Right? And it goes on to say on page 55... It says, actually, we're fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured, meaning blocked. And it talks about three things that I've been blocked by my whole life. Calamity. Freight train brain can't shut this thing off, right? Mm-hmm. For me, calamity is the fact that I had to play God in order to feel good about my life. And why is that? Well, if I'm trying to arrange a show to meet my needs, if I can only manage well, if only satisfaction of life and I manage well would bring me comfort, right? So what I do is I try to arrange the players and the director and the actor, and I'm trying to do all this stuff in my head, and I can't shut this thing off. Freight train brain, right? And it really comes down to fear. You know, self-centered fear. I'm afraid. I'm afraid of losing what I think I possess or not getting what I want. Right? So what I do is my calamity in my head is I'm trying to arrange everything to meet my needs, selfish and self-centered. And it talks about pumped, which is another word for ego, easing God out. Mm-hmm. And I'm an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. Right? I'm so extreme. I'm either way up here, you know, looking down on you, or I'm dirt beneath your feet. I never had any middle ground. Right? And I think the most important thing that it talks about is worship of other things. The human heart is wired to worship. It's not a matter of if I worship, it's a matter of what I worship. Right? When I was in high school and my mother was on welfare, single parent family, I worshiped money. Why? Because I thought if I had enough in my bank account, I'd be okay. I didn't want to be like my mother, you see. I didn't want to be on welfare. I had two jobs in high school. I was a workaholic. Right? It says, in God we trust on that dollar bill. Doesn't say in paper we trust. But I mistook the paper for the God. Right? That was my God. Money was my master. It wasn't my servant. Or status. Trying to fit in with everybody. Trying to be liked by everybody. Trying to be socially accepted by everybody. Validation from what you thought about me. I made you my higher power. You see, I had many gods in my life, just not the right one. I worship many things, many temporary things. And I think that's really the most important thing in those three things. Why? It's because of the worship of other things that I have calamity. You see, if I didn't worship money, I wouldn't have calamity. I wouldn't need to arrange things to meet my needs, right? If I trust and reliance upon God and I worshiped God rather than the material world, I'd probably have that peace I'd always been looking for via the bottle. But I thought I was apart from God. I never was apart from God. God even loves atheists. So I came to see that, right? it doesn't matter what I believed about God. God believed enough in me because He created me. And so it's a radical shift in my perception by taking actions I didn't believe in the beginning, but doing these things anyway because I came on self-imposed crises. Right? It's an amazing gift. And, so it's been quite a journey. It's been quite a journey for me. And, I'm going to move on to talking a little bit about step three here, where it goes on right after how it works. And it says on page 60, being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decide to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood Him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? The first requirement, it says requirement, not suggestion, right? The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we are almost in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like the actor who wants to run the whole show. He's forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. And this is what I'm doing. This is what creates calamity in my life, right? If his arrangements would only stay put, if people would do as he wishes, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, dishonest. But with most humans, he is more likely to have varied traits, right? So I'm a con artist. If I want to get something from you, I know how to act, right? I know how to be nice. Like my grandmother, we sat across from my grandmother's kitchen table, and we were real good at selling this plan to my grandmother about how we were going to be rich with real estate, right? Never panned out. So that I was trying to manipulate a situation to get what I wanted. Again, calamity, freight train brain, can't shut this thing off. I have no trust and reliance upon God. What usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think his life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play doesn't suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, right? It's funny, because they talk about our part in things, and somebody did something where they held up a piece of paper, and why words are important and why Bill uses certain words, right? If I were to only take my part in a situation, mm-hmm. it would probably be this little corner of the paper, and the rest of the part would be the other person. The rest of the paper would be the other person, right? So that's why he says mistakes in relationships and not part, right? Because I'm an egomaniac. They always are more to blame than I am. Always. Mm-hmm. Still, the play doesn't suit him. Admitting he might be somewhat at fault, he is sure that other people are more to blame. Mm-hmm. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can only wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only he manages well? It is not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants, and do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not, even in his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than of harmony? Our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. He is like the retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation, the minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century, politicians and reformers who are sure that all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave, the outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him, and the alcoholic who has lost all and is locked up. Mm-hmm. Whatever our protestations, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, mm-hmm. or our self-pity? Mm-hmm. Selfishness, this is my problem, right? Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. driven by a hundred forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows. Then they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that sometime in the past, we had made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. Mm-hmm. And that's my form of calamity, right? I place myself in the position to be hurt. Because of my plans and designs. I certainly did that with that relationship over a matter of a decade. I continue to place myself in a position to be hurt, right? And I'll finish it up with this. It talks about taking a position. And these are actually my favorite set of promises in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, being all-powerful, he provided what we needed. If we kept close to him and performed his work well, established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more we became interested in seeing what we contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we can face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We were reborn. And what I realized is that when I sincerely took a position to take direction and to do things I didn't believe in the beginning, these things were starting to come to life for me in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's kind of how I got to my first three steps. And you know, it's always a privilege and honor to have me come out and share with you guys. And that's more than enough for me until next week. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you.